Is that an extra pen down there?
Yes, sir.
Everybody have a chance to review the minutes from the last meeting? Any changes, recommendations? All right, so approved, then. That leaves us to...
Mention a couple of things, if I may.
All right.
Get started. The only contact we had was Skip Feller. He said he wouldn't be here tonight. I didn't hear from anyone else. And then we have new employees. Katie May Lauman, come on up here for a second. Katie May Lauman just joined us within the last couple of weeks, August 25th, actually, by way of Virginia Institute of Marine Science.
Great.
About to receive a PhD, has done some, what's important is she's done work on sturgeon genetics, both historical and maybe present, but she'll fill you in more on that, which is important to you because sturgeon, we're very close to submitting our incidental take plan. This is a plan that we're going to have 3 years to assess the takes by the gillnet fisheries. And after 3 years, we'll have to have a number that we give to the National Marine Fisheries Service. Right now, that number is 1,056, I think. But we have 3 years to revise and to get all the areas that we have information on. You're going to hear a little bit more about this probably next meeting, and I know Bob Fisher from Virginia Institute of Science would like to present information on some tagging that he's done, acoustic tagging. So it's pretty timely to have Katie May because we've already had our first conference with NIMS. They didn't find too much they didn't like about the plan, made some suggestions, and we'll be meeting with them again. But this is a huge issue. After 3 years, you know, we're subject to, if there are problems and too many takes, and a take is not a mortality, a take is as simple as an interaction with gear, then we could be subject to seasonal closures and all sorts of things. It's serious business. North Carolina and Georgia, I believe, have their take plans approved. We'll be the third state on the Atlantic coast once that's done. Katie May also will be working with the summer flounder recreational fishery items, so she'll be presenting information to you on that. That usually gets heated up about December and ends in February of next year, so Katie May will be doing that as well. She'll also be working on forage fish, which is relatively new to all of us, but there's a big push for the Mid-Atlantic Council, the ASMSC, Chesapeake Bay, the Gold Implementation Team, anywhere you look, forage fish are now getting a lot of attention. Unmanaged forage fish will be here tomorrow. The council will have a representative to talk about unmanaged forage fish. That'll last from 5 to 8 tomorrow night. That's not all Katie May will be doing, but those are the highlights, right?
Yes.
Have you been introduced, Jill? Jill, come on up.
Welcome aboard, Katie.
Jill Ramsey started, I'm going to guess here, 6 months?
February, yep.
Okay, in February. And she started off as a mandatory reporting technician. She now has the wonderful position of handling all the striped bass transfers and keeping up with the database there. And in addition, you know, she's learning things that she had hoped she would learn, so she's moving along pretty well and has quite a really nice background, not to mention all the places she's been when she talked to me at one point about all the places that she's been able to live and visit. So she's going to be a really good addition for us. We're a little strapped for personnel. Joe Grist left on August the 7th, if you didn't know that. He went to work for the City of Newport News after 9 years with the commission and 3 years as my deputy. And we lost some other folks, too. So it's pretty bare bones time. So Katie May will be coming up kind of quickly. Rachel's been with us for a little while. She's moving really fast. Lewis moves at a lightning speed pace tonight. And, you know, this is really, when you think about it, and Joe, you know, Joe's been here about 11 years and just has done an incredible job in all the different facets that he's been with the agency, which are three different companies. So keep that in mind. I gave this little pep talk about a year and a half ago. When you think you have an idea that you want staff to do something, please consider we have the same number of employees that we had in 1991, before we had any ASMFC mandates. I mean, it's unbelievable, but we have 26 employees for the entire fisheries management world. So thanks a lot for that moment.
Okay.
Yep. Mr. O'Reilly, do you have a new deputy?
No. Don't know when we'll have a new deputy, so if I look a little ragged,
I was just wondering who to complain to other than you.
Well, right now, it has to be for me.
Okay.
You look good for somebody with such advanced years.
Yes.
Okay, well, that takes us to Cano's raise, I guess. Do we have anybody here in the audience that represents the issue, the people that are concerned about the raise and...
Fisher, who's probably done the most definitive work on this biology, tagging, whatever. I didn't know he was going to be here, but I'm glad to see him.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
And we've got a commission member that was at the commission meeting and participated in the discussion, and Rob presented it to the commission.
Okay.
I wasn't there. We had a kids' fishing clinic. It was that day, and we were doing the fish ID lab. But, listened to the tape. Received any other calls since it came before the commission, and it was a request to eliminate bow hunting from Cano's raise, and for their careful consideration, I thought it should come to you folks, but I'll touch on some background information.
Yeah, it's getting a little bright. I really want to tell them what happened to the commission before you start.
Got it all here. I could just go through that. Maybe that's all I'll do. Yes, there was a request to eliminate bow hunting at Cano's raise at the last commission meeting. By way of background, there's currently no restrictions, no season, size, or possession limit for raise, Cano's raise, or other raise in Virginia waters. There's no directed commercial fishery. Look at the landings, and they're less than 12,000 pounds. The harvest estimate for recreational fishermen for all species of rays the last 3 years is average 2,000 rays or less. Unfortunately, the stock status is unknown. All that's required to bow hunt for rays or anything else that's legal, when I say anything else that's legal, today, you can't take sharks with a bow. You can't shoot straight bass, but anything else, if I've got a saltwater fishing license, I can bow hunt for the same species, and I go by the same season and possession. Unfortunately, because of that, we have no special bow hunting license for marine water or marine species, so we don't have any documentation of bow hunters. If it was working, got a nice picture here in this show. this is a, as an example, not all the rays taken by bow hunters are Kano's rays, and that's really why they included this to maybe show it to you. The majority of those rays look like southern stingrays, and just this one in the middle is actually Kano's ray. Kano's rays move into the bay in May, generally, really for three things: to pup, breed, and feed. Females reach maturity around 8, and they average just one pup per year. Apparently, they found more than one pup in the other uterus, so it's possible they could have more than one, but you know, they're a typical shark. They have a low number of young and mature at a late age. After breeding, many of the males leave by July, and referencing the work that Bob Fisher did, their study indicates soft-shell clams and fish such as menhaden are very important food items, but of course, oystermen and clam and oyster culturists will tell you otherwise. Cow-nose rays, they consider a major predator for their shellfish. Cow-nose rays can also damage SAV beds. I wonder, well, how do they do that? Well, the way they harvest or get at burrowed mollusks is they use their wings, and it's almost a dredging type operation. You'll find these holes in the SAV beds, literally uproots the SAV as they go after various shellfish. BIM / the Sea Grant Program and Marine Products Board have attempted to develop a commercial market at least two times since I've been here, once 15, 20 years ago, and more recently made another attempt at it, and it's just success has been very elusive due mainly to high production costs. There's a lot of waste, things that they can't market for in a cow-nose ray, and they're not difficult to, they are difficult to process generally. As Robin indicated, it's not a nice, neat, white meat steak, but we have it. All of us, including the commissioners at the time, tasted it, and a lot of other folks that were at a commission meeting that prepared properly. It's pretty tasty. And certainly, I've gotten anecdotal comments from anglers, for bow hunters, saying, yeah, we really like it. We get them, and you know, get a dozen of them and do a fish fry. So, like I've always told people, I said, well, can you eat them? I said, I don't care what it is. If it's alive, somebody somewhere eats it and likes it. I think that's the case with the cow-nose rays. I don't think it's for everything. In the development of any kind of fishery or plan that would eliminate cow-nose rays, BIMS has always urged caution because of their life history. They're easily overfished, and there's some suggestion that they could very well be a species where you've got this tipping effect where need a relatively large population to function and breed properly, and once you go beyond that point, the population could collapse. And we do know that these things migrate in large, I call them flocks, from the days when we were doing flyovers from Black Drum over on the Eastern Shore. You look down and you see a flock of those things moving. It's not something that's new for the Bay, because Stingray Point supposedly was named because of Captain John Smith, who was speared a ray of some kind, likely a cow-nose ray, for dinner, and thought he was going to die there. He ended up naming it Stingray Point. Likewise, as Robert indicated, the Sustainable Fisheries Golden Implementation Team is working towards a bay-wide management plan on cow-nose rays. All this was in place well before, and I'll get to what I think was a tipping point with regards to cow-nose rays and the fact that it came before the commission. Here's an example, and in my perusal of internet and websites and that type of thing, surprising number of guides and other associations are also showing, hey, you play this thing, it is edible, I don't think you just shoot it and trash it. I'll throw that in there. It does appear that bow hunting is on the increase, and I talked to the folks at the game department, and they say the same thing. Bow hunting is very popular for theater in, within the state. And I went through and looked at, came up with 31 different bow hunting associations with that have websites. So it's a popular sport, and it is growing. And according to the game department, they've seen an increase in bow hunting in their waters. Has really been for the snakehead. And it appears it's been really effective at getting large fish. They go out at night with lights, and they're shooting bowfin. I mean, not bowfin. They're shooting snakeheads, and inadvertently, while they're out there, they've seen bowfin and carp and gar, all of which are considered non-game species, and you're allowed to shoot those animals with bow and arrow. And Department of Game and Inland Fisheries Waters, and they have concern about that activity is increasing, and they're looking at it not because of Caldo's rays, but because of the other species that are in their waters. Again, this was prior to the event that occurred this spring, that several animal rights activist groups were calling for some controls on bow hunting, citing that most of the animals being shot are the bigger ones, and they're females. And in the springtime, they are pregnant. And they indicate, well, same thing, their life history. They only have one pup, and they claim many of these animals were just being wasted, just shot merely for the sport, and then chucked overboard at some point in time. As I referenced, this tipping point appears to have been reached this spring, when individuals participating in a rape bow fishing tournament were filmed by one of the animal activist groups shooting, clubbing, tossing into barrels, and later dumping overboard hundreds of pounds of very bloody and dead rays. They found it appalling that they would use clubs on these things, but anyone that's been out there and fished for a number of species, that probably the quickest and safest way for all parties concerned to subdue these things and get them in the cooler is to even knock them out real quick. So it really, but just if they had staged an event to incite this, they couldn't have done a better job. It was a bloody mess. And this video, and I'm not going to, didn't even attempt to get it on here, show it to you, but if you want to find it, it's certainly out there, and more of them are different pieces and parts. It was widely circulated on the internet, and as they say, went viral, and the public discussed reached Richmond, and that's where the Secretary of Natural Resources got involved and requested the commission consider banning bow hunting arrays. So I indicated that at the commission meeting, Commission debated this for a period of time and said, no, we're not ready to go to public hearing. We want to send it to you folks and get your advice. What is the next, what's the best course from here? This is not even a bad one. This does appear to be all Caldo's rays, but you don't have to look hard to find some photos indicating that at least two people. I don't really know what they're going to do with all those rays, but it's going to be one heck of a fish fry. That's where they're headed. So, answer questions. Again, the good thing is you've got two individuals who are at the commission meeting, and this fisher that probably has the best information or science that we would have for rays that are in the Chesapeake Bay for the 3 months plus or so that they're here.
When is the Baywide Management Plan supposed to be completed?
It's an ongoing process. I don't know if they've set a date for it. I'm sure it's going to be one of these things where the date it's going to be data poor.
They haven't written the budget. It might be the management plan. We're going to talk about the GIT having a workshop on the 21st. Discuss that. GIT got very interested in this a couple of months back, but there's a lot to work out as far as who would be at the workshop and funding and everything else like that. What the commission wanted was to have you tonight talk this over a little bit, provide some advice to commission. The commission was also interested in the workshop. And so what they would like is a report back at this meeting of what FMAC determines is maybe what course of action to go on. And then the commission is also interested to hear about the results from the workshop when that happens. And so, you know, it is twofold.
Okay. Any questions from anybody else? Robert?
Isn't this kind of contradictive to what we were working on several years ago because of the oyster industry? We're trying to get rid of these things, and now you want to protect them? Evidently, these people don't see the damage that's being done years ago before a lot of these people were around. The hall singers used to haul sand at night and catch them by the thousands of them, and just throw them up in the marsh grass for the buzzards to eat. That never hurt the population. And we're talking about just a few people shooting them with a bow and arrow, and they want to band it. That's kind of ridiculous. These things cause a lot of damage.
Anyone else?
Is Bob going to give some kind of presentation, or is this we're just having a discussion now?
I doubt he was prepared. I'm very happy to see him when I looked around. I smiled at him, happy to see him. But we don't have any population estimate.
I know Bob's been studying them 20 years or more. Isn't it unusual we don't even have a vague idea of the population after 20 years?
Would you enlighten us, please?
Oh, yeah.
Anything you can give us that would help, we'd appreciate.
Bob Fisher with Marine Science. And I have spent a lot of time with the Counter Gray issue. Started in 1990 when we did a marketing, trying to market the product. And we've been trying ever since. But about 2004, I did a vergence from looking at the marketing solely to look at biological assessment of that species, because we eventually are going to have a fishery of some sort, either a bycatch fishery or a directive fishery or something, that we have to have some type of management in place for this, because it is a flattened shark. It has all the characteristics of a shark species that provide it to be a K-selective species, that we've got to have that understanding, so when we do start fishing these things, that we don't overfish them, okay? That said, try to get a couple of the questions. I just need to correct some of the things that was presented so far, just so we have, you know, consistent information, because this whole cow nose ray issue, ever since I've been here, is just covered with misinformation, because watermen throw all the whippoorwills, everything they call a skate or a ray, they don't differentiate between the species, which is very problematic in the marketing of it and also on the biological end. Some of the southern stingrays and the blunt nose and other ray species give multiple or have multiple litters, 5, 6, 7, 8 pups per female per year. The cow nose ray only has one, okay? So we're looking at a certain species here, okay? The other problems or the other things we need to keep into consideration is the one slide up there that said what they feed on, okay? Because the whole crux of the whole cow nose ray issue is its interaction with our valuable shellfish species in the bay. If that was not a problem until we started culturing and extensive culturing when the rays would just feed on a certain size, there was never a problem with the rays, okay? You mentioned finfish in the report or in there. They do not, fish are not part of their natural diet, okay? That, from my report, is when I was looking at fishery-dependent sampling, where I was first looking at ray stomach content that were harvested by both pound net and haul seine. Both of those gear types have an artifact when you're looking at stomach content. Cow nose ray are highly opportunistic feeding, so when the fish get gilled in those nets in that resident period, they're going to feed on those fish. In the wild, they do not follow or actively pursue fish as in their part of their natural diet. That's important, one of the important things to understand. that goes into the another aspect of what, why we're here today. Because I saw that bias in their stomach content and what their natural prey items would be, I had to go to fishery independent sampling, where we looked at modified pair trawls. We pulled them in the back river to get the rays out of the water when we see them, so we could process their stomachs and see what they were feeding on instead of any type of residual period like in the traditional gear types. Another way we did that is long lining. We long line on different sides of the bay and in conjunction with oyster growing companies, as well as just in other chosen habitats. So we're trying to take them from different habitats to see what their natural diet. The other type of gear type that I use or method of harvesting is bow fishing. I did solicit and I got the help from the Whistling Dixie Bow Hunters Association to remove rays for my sampling program. And that was one of the most efficient ways of taking rays directly out of the water and preserve what they were feeding on at the time in the different areas. So again, bow fishing has been part of, you know, taking of rays, okay? And I'm not sure where you want to go with this as a group. I don't look at the gear type or how it's taken, you know, personally. I just worry about, you know, what it may lead to as far as removing certain species out of the bay that should be utilized. Again, it is a fishery resource. I'm a believer that fishery resources should be used and utilized, but efficiently and responsibly. Count those rays when they come into the bay, just for added information for you guys to think about. No matter when we have interaction with the rays, when we have the ability to take a ray out of the Chesapeake Bay, we are going to be taking two out for every female we take. This whole migratory effort, when they come in the summer, is a reproductive effort. So they overwinter off of Cape Canaveral, Florida, and that stretch of the coastal Florida. In the springtime, they move up the coast and they go into the various estuarine environments, northern North Carolina, Chesapeake Bay, the sounds in the estuaries on the eastern shore side, Delaware Bay, up in the Sandy Hook Bay. And for one reason only, is to bring their gestated embryos to term. When they reach the Chesapeake Bay, every female, because it is a reproductive effort, there's no young a year, there's no teenagers involved with this migration. Okay, the rays that you see that come in the bay are at reproductive age, which is 7 to 8 years old. No young, we still don't understand where the teenagers are, where they go to, and that's part of my research currently.
I can answer that question for you. Well, I drum fish for years, and the first in the ocean, first thing you catch is the big ones. They start real close to the beach. I can move away from them at first. You know, then as they get real abundant, you have to take your drum nets in. We'll go down to smaller nets, and then after the big ones go by, you're inundated with little ones.
That's in the fall?
In the spring.
Spring.
Anything from, I would think, fairly newborns up until half, two-thirds grown. I mean, they get more abundant than the big ones do after the big ones are gone. So, you know, you might not have been sampling in the right place, or maybe they don't go there. Maybe they stay in the ocean to go further north, but.
Yeah, they definitely are not in the bay. From all of our other VIMS trawl surveys and stuff, we don't find the teenagers in the bay.
I mean, you know, if you would come home in July, I could sink any boat you want with the juveniles.
In the bay?
No, I'm on Chincoteague in the ocean.
That's what I'm saying. In the Chesapeake.
You know, we got just as you're talking about Chesapeake Bay, but count those rays have a whole lot water ranged in the Chesapeake Bay.
Okay. Thank you. When they come in the beginning of May, they show up religiously within a two-week period between the 1st of May in that time frame. They are at three-quarter term gestation, and it takes all the way up to the end of June, mid-June, the end of June, for the pups to reach maturity and at term, and that's when the females pup. By the second week of July, typically the first week of July, they have already been mated with and already pregnant with the next embryo developing in them. So their gestation is 11 and a half to almost 12-month gestation period. They get pregnated as soon as they drop their pups. So when after that happens, the males leave the bay. Through our tracking and our telemetry tracking and our satellite tag, archival tag tracking, we are finding out that after mating in the beginning of July, they leave the males leave the bay, and only the females of reproductive age are left in the bay until about this time. They're starting to move down the bay, and they'll be out of the bay within a couple weeks from now. But that lets you know that I'm bringing this whole life history when they're in the bay for the reason is that that's when we have access to them for a fishery. And this is when these bow fishing tournaments happened to be when there was no males around. There were only females, which are the bigger of the species. They have that sexual dimorphism in the ray. So it is a timing factor. I think it was a poor timing factor for some of these tournaments that target only the pregnant females. And plus, you know, it's your decision on how you want to do it. But the whole relationship of the life history of the Count Ojibway makes it inevitable that you are going to target the larger individuals for any type of trophy fishing.
My question is, could you comment on predators, natural predators, and other than man, and how effective is it, you know, in maintaining a reasonable population?
It has always been the elasmobranch biologists and the shark biologists have always contended that the main predator for the Count Ojibway or on the Count Ojibway were the nearshore shark species that inhabited the east coast. And with their decline, there was supposed to be an explosion of the population of the Count Ojibway. Looking at the Count Ojibway population is very difficult, and this is where management is going to have a very hard time to try to look at population dynamics on this species just by the nature of how they their life histories and how they move. We've done a genetic stock discrimination study, Jan McDowell and myself, and we identified that these Count Ojibway that enter the Chesapeake Bay and the East Coast are a separate stock from the Gulf of Mexico rays and the Brazilian rays. We also found that there is a mix between the Brazilian and the Gulf, but our stock here is a separate stock in a genetic pool. And the way they migrate and move in their behavior, this is one stock that we're talking about that moves up the bay and fractionates. Some come into the Chesapeake Bay and others skirt it and go up the Delaware and other tributaries. So trying to get an estimate, any type of population estimate, on the overall population of this species is very difficult because you look at traditional ways of doing that, tag and recapture. You tag fish in the southern part on their migration up, you're going to get most tag recoveries of where they're interacting with our halseners and pound netters and things in the bay, but elsewhere along the outside of the eastern shore and over there, we're not going to get very much recovery tag information and stuff. So it's very problematic to try to get a handle on how many Count Ojibway there actually are.
Okay.
So in the predation thing, you know, cobia eat. You know, we found that the cobia feed on the young a year, the small ones when they go too. But not many predators for the Count Ojibway.
Any other questions? Okay, Robert?
What is the benefit for people? We found out that they're not good for food. What is the benefit of having them?
Well, that depends on who, you know, where your position is. If you're, you know, you already referenced that they do have some negative aspects of their population because of the way we are culturing our different seafoods here. They interact, okay? And they uproot vegetation when they're trying to get benthic organisms out of the bottom. And by the way, most of their food, their natural diet, is a very weak shelled, not soft shelled was mentioned up here. And most people, when you say soft shelled clam, you think of Maya, you know. But
Maya hasn't been around since the 60s in any type of numbers, you know, for them to feed on. We're talking about weak valved. This better term would be weak valved, weak shelled clams, Macoma, Tagulus, those type of clams make up by far the majority of their diet, as well as little decapods, the little mud crabs and things, and benthic worms. So when they're feeding, trying to mine them out of the substrate, they do create those divots in the bottom. They do uproot SAV if the SAV is in that same area where they're sensing their food comes from. So in those aspects, they have detriment effect. And then, you know, one researcher says to me about the digging and mining, if they uproot SAV from this area, the currents are going to take it, and because they're rhizomes, and they can repopulate different areas. So, you know, there's all this give and take of what this species presents in the bay. It's been here for a very long time. Some of my feeding behavioral studies where I've had the cow nose rays for 5-6 years, summers in a row in my tanks, filming them, how they feed, how they process things, how they interact with different size and shape of shellfish, how they interact with spat on shell, and how they feed them.
Some of your videos where they actually drop and try to crush
yes.
something by dropping it to the bottom.
Yeah, they're very smart animals. They will use the bottom as a tool to help them individualize the cluster, and then once they get one off, it opens up space and everything else. But what I did find out in doing that work is that they by far do not want to go after spat on shell or oysters that are part of natural reefs and stuff. I couldn't imagine them feeding on them in the wild, you know, in the 1800s, because their whole mouth region is full of little tiny pores, which are the ampullae of Lorenzini. It's the way they electroreception. It's how they detect food, the heartbeats of different animals, and that's how they communicate and find prey items and stuff. When they're feeding on clustered oysters like spat on shell, they get lacerated. I mean, the rays after they're feeding in just a few trials just totally get.
We're not having a problem with them on my bed because that's what we did. We made you have to take a whole flock to break them loose, and they
yes.
can't get them loose.
Nope. And they lose a lot of their teeth also versus just feeding on individual cultureless oysters and stuff. So they do have a detriment in one aspect, depending on if you're a shellfish grower, you know, and or if you're very adamant about SAV not rerooting if they uproot it. And again, I'm not sure, as a scientist, I'm not sure if the burrows that they make in the bottom, if that's bad or not, because they are oxygenating the bottom when they're feeding. I mean, there's a lot of things that we see, depending on where you're standing, is are the rays a villain, or are the rays, you know, always been there and we just gotta, you know, they're part of the ecosystem.
I would still like to know what benefit do we get from them.
Well, like I just mentioned, you know, if they're aerating the bottom.
If that grass would read, if it was attached somewhere else, then yeah, it would help spread the grass.
Right.
But other than that,
we don't know.
They do a whole lot more damage than they do good.
You know, they're an apex predator in our environment because they feed on the benthic environment, the worms and things like that. Without the removal of a lot of those polychaete worms and things like that, that the rays feed on, and the mud crabs and things like that, you know, that's part of the network. So I don't know. If you remove the rays, no one knows what would happen.
Well, I'm not saying remove them, but I'm saying they want to start putting restrictions on them. And I personally think it's kind of ridiculous because they do more damage than they do good. So to protect them would be like the blue catfish.
That's another species I'm working on. That's
I figured.
But I think the issue today, and the only interest I have, is to, you know, just to shed information for you guys to have that information to make your decisions and be here if you have any specific questions. Again, personally, I'd love to give always my personal attitude towards things, but that's not my position here.
All right. I've heard fishermen tell me that they also eat crabs, blue crabs. Is that, did that show up in your?
Yes, very small amounts. But again, they're so highly opportunistic that they are going to feed on what you give them. And that was learned by the Corps of Engineer, and all of us should have got it the first time, but we were thick-headed, I think, where they seeded the reefs with 25 to 30 millimeter seeds when the rays are in the bay. I mean, that's just like ringing the dinner bell. I mean, you can't expect a durophage predator, you know, that's whole engineered for crushing things, not to feed on something individual like that and just out there. So, if there's food around, and they're going to feed on it.
And they're less likely to feed on the spat-on shell than they are on those small.
Yes. It takes them a lot longer to feed on them. And it's a good, spat-on shell is a good deterrent.
Okay.
It slows down the feeding rate. It's not going to stop it, though.
Okay.
I would like to know your feelings on where do you see the fishery going? Do you feel bow hunting is bad for them? Do you feel it should be banned? It's, you know, seasons, you know, what are your thoughts on it?
That's again, I'm not here to give you my personal feeling. That's not my
I understand. Theory. I was just curious your thoughts on it.
But I have been, and I've been criticized many times because, again, I mentioned that to you. I'm doing that tool. I have a divergence in my responsibility, I think, finding a market for the animal and also getting the science there. If you look at that, those are two opposing views. What I do, or I can say on a personal level, because I've been working, I used to be a commercial fisherman out of San Diego, and I've worked in the Northern California fisheries and the Gulf fisheries. I've been with the fisheries for 30-some years now. Cal Nose Ray is a fishery resource, and fishery resources, as far as I'm concerned, are here to be utilized, and it's up to us to find the best ways to utilize them and manage them correctly.
All right. I have a comment.
Okay.
It sounds to me like more data is needed on the extent of Cal Nose Ray catches, takes, whatever you want to call it. And I agree with Mr. Wigley that that we should not place restrictions on bow hunting or rod and reel or net or whatever, you know, method. But since it is a concern to fisheries managers and other groups, perhaps some form of mandatory reporting or sampling, at least, to get some feel for how many are being killed would be in order. But I don't think we ought to ban any form of taking them at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Yes, sir.
Is there nobody in the audience that's in the bow fishery? Are any charter boat captains or guys for hire guys?
I'd like to make a comment about it.
Oh, well,
I don't fish for them.
You get a chance. Yeah, I'm a little surprised that there's nobody here on one side or the other that's really pushing for this. But the secretary,
were they aware of?
Well, they know they had to go before us before they went before the VMRC.
Yeah, and then at the same time that you all read the agenda, it's posted on our website. Anyone that's ever asked for the agendas to be mailed out, there's a mailing list that we sent out.
I have a question.
The Secretary of Natural Resources has asked us to address this, so we should address it as best we can at the moment. Yes, Beth?
My question is, I hear the emphasis on the tournaments. I mean, how many tournaments a year do we have here, and how do we find this information out? I mean, because are we looking at two tournaments a year, or isolated situation, or it's hard to make a decision on something when we don't have all the data on it.
One big tournament in June, and that is, you know, another side tournament. But I was all they were interested in was stopping the wanton waste, which has become, you know, a phrase that's been heard many times since that video came about. And of course, they feel that way about any animal species. So, you know, we did meet with those folks a few weeks ago. I don't know whether they'll end up at a commission meeting or not, but you know, I think for tonight, you know, we're just getting started a little bit. There is some time, obviously. We're heading out of the, you know, you heard Bob Fisher mention the departure of the males already. And, you know, it's time that we can at least look at this over some time. And maybe what happens is the workshop, if it gets pulled off, and I assume there's a lot of momentum to pull it off, then that provides other information that can be fed back to you. You can feed it back to the commission. So.
Mr. Fisher, is there a time, and I apologize for getting a little conflicted here with all the different schedules, is there a time when there are where they're more likely to get males or just as likely to get males as females, a better time to have the tournaments?
Yes, there is that part of their life history. That BMRC funded a study of mine several years ago where it was titled Where Do the Males Go? And that's a big part of the whole puzzle because of the situation I already mentioned of how the females come in at any point when we have access to them, we'll be taking two out of the resource, them and the recruit, no matter if it's a new recruit or not. So it's very important that we understand where the males do go so we can direct the fishery towards a male-only fishery or whatnot comes down the line. We have, since that study, we through the telemetry study and the satellite tagging study, we have pretty much definitively demonstrated that after mating, the males leave the Chesapeake Bay, and we have found them offshore all the way up off of Long Island at this point during the summer, and they wait for the females, and they all come back down and merge outside the mouth of the bay, and they migrate south as a mixed sex population, and they migrate north as a mixed sex population. So yes, there is that point up to the first week in July, second week in July, when it is a mixed sex in the bay.
So they come in at the same time as the females?
Yes, sir.
So there's really no particular time that we could concentrate in the bay on just males?
You could at the beginning, yes, from May to the end of June. The males are still there.
But they're mixed with the females.
They're mixed with females. And there is that dimorphism, size dimorphism. I mean, the males have the claspers, you know, but are hard to see, you know, because they're ventrally oriented. But by size, if you went by size, because these animals are the reproductive age individuals, there's no, you know, smaller ones that are with this. You can go by size as an indicator of sex to some degree.
These pups then are not actually born in the bay.
Yes, sir.
They develop in the bay.
No, they're born in the bay. When the females get pregnant at the beginning of July, they hold them, and when they leave the bay to go south, they're in their first stage of gestation. They're about this big right now. When the rays come back to the bay in May, the pups are about, you know, 12 inches. They're about 14 to 16 inches, and they're born in their tributaries. That's something that, which is interesting too, if just to answer this question, but also give you another piece of the puzzle that I'm trying to work on, natal homing. They're showing a tendency to natal home. I say this because four rays that I tagged coming from Pocosin, I tagged and released at VIMS there in New York. They were picked up going down to Cape Canaveral off of Georgia, receivers off of Georgia, off of South Carolina, and off of Canaveral. They have a resident period. They were detected off Canaveral, and those same rays were detected coming back and picked up those same receivers in Georgia and South Carolina, and they came back to where we collected them from. So that gives us an indication that these animals may have some sort of site fidelity associated with them, meaning that they come back to the same areas that they were born. And yes, they are born. The group that come in, the bay, the mouth of the bay, they're in the bay at one tributary or the other, and that's where they give birth, and that's where the young are born, and then they leave in the first to mid-October. They're gone out of the bay.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, it sounds like we know we need more information. We've learned a lot. I just hope that we've done enough. If we consider this the first step, have we done enough to satisfy the Secretary of Natural Resources and the two groups that have a right to ask that we try to address this situation? And I'm sorry, Bob, if Dr. Allen, if you'd like to comment.
I'm Bob Allen. I'm from the Peninsula Saltwater Sports Fishing Association. I was having lunch with somebody from the Northern Neck who is, I think he's a charter boat captain, and he is a recreational fisherman. And he made a comment about there was a hearing here at VMRC on Cow Nose Rays tonight, that it came up at VMRC, and I'd never heard of it before. I was shocked. I went on the internet and looked at the pictures. I wanted to see. It's a very, very popular recreational sport to spearfish. You can see it all over YouTube. They're all over the country, and people are doing it. And I talked to somebody at a sports shop here, and they said it's a growing sport. Nevertheless, I was surprised that this Bob Reed was not here tonight, because he made the comment that it is a big tournament event up the bay, and I don't know whether it was in Maryland or Northern Neck, but Bob Reed is on the Finfish Advisory Committee, and so the staff can talk to him about it and find out, you know, what he knows about it, about the tournaments up the bay, because evidently they have some tournaments up the bay, and that's evidently part of what we're looking at here. Now, I'm very glad that the Secretary of Natural Resources wasn't on my boat today, because I murdered about 15 oyster toads, and that isn't the first time I've murdered oyster toads. I murder them quite frequently, and I'm sure they fit into the environment somewhere, but they are sure a pest. They're a pest, and I kill everyone that I can get my hands on, and I hope the Secretary of Resources doesn't find out about it and have PETA or somebody, you know, up in trouble, right? So I'm kind of like Mr. Weekly. I don't think these fish are important to us as fishermen or oystermen or whatever, and I don't think we should do any talk about limiting their catch. Thank you.
Thank you.
A little bit of advice for Bob there.
Yeah.
If you catch big oyster toads, they're one of the most expensive fish you can catch in the state of Virginia. You keep them alive to around $15 a pound.
I'm a selfish.
I'm just saying, you know, if there is a market for them. You said you hope there was a use.
They're supposed to be excellent eating. I've heard the same thing.
Yeah, I know people who do it.
Okay. So
I'm gonna sell you the next ones.
Okay. Anybody on the committee have any suggestions as to additional things that we need to address?
One more question. Rob, how long would it take to get enough data to do a threshold and a target and all that stuff on these things? Or would it be worth it?
How long do we have? All right.
How much staff?
You know the answer to that.
I know your staff is kind of showing.
Yeah, you know the answer to that. I mean, really, I will tell you again what Bob Fisher told you. We're talking about a fishery resource. We ought to figure out how to use or utilize it. I agree with that completely. And we're going to need some help from science to, at some point, the way things go, there are a number of species that you could think of, each of you could think of, that 10 years ago or 20 years ago you didn't think would be a resource that was going to be harvested, and yet you turn around and it is. So we want to work, viewpoint here is we want to work towards a fishery. We're going to have to be very cautious about that, obviously, because it is a problem. The biology of the Cownose Ray is a big problem as far as, you know, reproductive efforts. So, you know, that's really the direction we're going. The other thing is you're really not answering for the Secretary of Natural Resources. The Secretary of Natural Resources already made her position known, brought it to the commission. So now you're working back for who you should be, the commission. That's what the advisory panel does. It really gives advice to the commission. Tonight I've heard three distinct, we really don't need to do anything, messages. That doesn't mean this is over. We can talk again probably after the workshop and put this into context, because there aren't a whole lot of people who have a whole lot of information about cownose rays, and you heard Bob Fisher say that he started in 1990, but you won't find a lot of other people like that. So the workshop is supposed to bring together a lot of the experts. That may help to put all this in perspective. That's the way I'm looking at it. And I think you've given us enough to at least...
I think it's basically don't do any knee-jerk reaction to ban, you know, taking them. Just let's study the thing and find out, get some more data.
Said the same thing, by the way. So almost the exact same words. So we'll report on this on the 22nd and see what else the commission would like. And I think what they're going to say is, well, we know there will be a workshop at some time soon, and let's put everything in perspective once we have that workshop and talk about the bow hunting again. You're not going to find any bow hunting clubs that are going to come here and address this unless there are bow hunting clubs that don't have wanton waste. They actually try and utilize the product. And that's the kind of group that it'd be nice to get them here to talk about their practice and everything else. So I hope that sounds all right.
It does. I want to add two more points that I've learned since this became a discussion point. They are preyed upon by large sharks, and most inshore large sharks now are protected. So there will be more predation from large sharks. And I stopped by Bass Pro Shops on the way here purely for scientific research. And they have a boat out front, a John boat, aluminum John boat, with a deck attached to it that is clearly a bow hunting deck. So it is gaining in popularity. The suppliers are actually addressing that, and it will no doubt become even more popular. So it is something that we need to address. And the people that brought it before us, I mean, the video, I didn't watch it, but it was apparently appalling. So we need to be more respectful with whatever we catch, whether we're going to use it or not. So they have a right to be heard, and we need to address their concerns. Thank you. What's next?
Dogfish.
Dogfish it is.
Better when Lewis couldn't get this going because I didn't really have a PowerPoint ready. I had to run back in my office. Pull up just a few items for discussion. Hopefully you all have the agenda in front of you, and it pretty well lays out why we're here. In January, FMAC had voted to allow some limited amount of permit to be transferred, and this is a limited entry fishery, and we didn't really get a criteria for that laid out. So just a little background, there was an initial round of there was an initial criteria set in 2009 to limit entry into this fishery. Now let's get this in proper mode here. Okay. And we looked at active participants in the fishery, so anyone that had landings, and you can see there were two different criteria to qualify during the 2006 to 2008 time frame. and that left us with 101 permit tees. Then in 2012, an individual came before you asking about transfers for this fishery, and we've been discussing it ever since. So we did a second round of cuts because it was decided that before you can allow, with the assumption that a transferred permit would become an active permit, there were quite a few inactive permits. We showed a lot of several years of landings data that there weren't more than 50 to 53 people that were active in any given year or any given season. So that was half of those permits were sitting out there inactive. Discussion revolved around the fact that the fishery couldn't handle 100 active permits, and it would make a lot more sense to really get these numbers down. Really, the talk at the time was that this is a traditional fishery of 30 to 40 boats, and you know, maybe the permits should represent that number. But that second round of cuts, which limited entry only to the most recent previous two seasons, got us down to only reduced a few permits. We're now down to 82 permits. We still have a few individuals who are not in this fishery who are really looking to get back into it. You can see that there's no agents in this fishery. It's one of the few fisheries where we do not allow agenting, which is one individual who has a permit can pass that permit and his or her commercial card off to another individual to fish their nets and in particular fish in this fishery for them. And transfers are extremely limited to either military and medical hardship or a transfer, an immediate transfer within the family. In particular, in January, you had an individual come before you that was looking for an ability to transfer. It would have been under a medical hardship, but they were explaining that they would not be able to get the permit back to the original permit holder since the individual that then held it wouldn't have had a medical hardship. So there was discussion here by your committee on allowing some limited number. There was talk of 3 to 5 transfers per year, but we really didn't flesh out any sort of criteria to allow transfers within this limited entry fishery. And, to be quite frank, the commissioner's made it clear that he's not interested in, you know, picking and choosing. He really wants to hear what this committee has to say on what's the appropriate way to get permits. If the committee still feels that transfers are appropriate, what's the best way to do that?
Okay. Before we do, do we know that what's the status of the stock and what's the market like? I mean, should we be trying to really drastically reduce the number, or is it improving? I know the total allowable catch went up.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, in the last few years we've seen you could see our right now we've got a 5.4 nearly 5.5 million pound quota. It's been drastically going up since 2012. In 2011-12, we had a 1 million pound quota that we caught in about 10 days, and we actually exceeded the quota. Since then, between market issues and this ever increasing quota, we've come nowhere near reaching our quota. We do have a somewhat looming threat with the upcoming quota, though. You know, we don't know necessarily what actions Mid-Atlantic Council will have to take on that, but they are looking at a situation where, due to previous survey results, they're talking about cutting the coastwide quota to reflect with the current catches, and as I said, the current catch is nowhere near the coastwide quota. So it could be, you know, there's a potential for at least a one-year significant quota reduction.
Okay. All right. Yes, ma'am.
Does the dogfish license, does it, I mean, what does it cost to get something like that? Because they're so limited. I guess my concern is if you have someone that has one and ends up having a medical situation and they're not of sound body and mind to, you know, come to us or transfer or whatever, then the process that goes into effect with the family, you don't want someone selling it. Or, do you see what I'm saying? You want to make sure that it's in fairness?
Yeah, we don't set any monetary value to these
so
permits.
So they just originally applied, they didn't have to pay money to get the permit? Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
They qualified.
They qualified,
right. So it was only
so it wouldn't be something that would be sold for money?
Well, it certainly can be. Any of our limited entry fisheries, you know, if there were transfers allowed, you would assume that the individual that holds that history and eligibility would be interested in getting money to turn that over to somebody else. And that's what's happened with all our other limited entry fisheries.
And market conditions have not gotten any better. It's actually, it's gotten worse on the sales end. I talked to Walt from Sea Trade today, and he said that his number one buyer in the Netherlands is actually saying, you need to get the price down for us to be able to sell more volume. And Walt's saying, if we get the price down, we're not going to have any boats fishing. So I was on the phone in for 30 minutes before I walked in here tonight just to find out what was going on. And he felt like, you know, and Massachusetts has only produced 13% of their quota so far this year. He said they've had boats go out of business. They're just, the fish aren't where they normally are, and they're not getting the product. And still with not getting the product, they can't get the price up. So nothing has changed market-wise. I think we can hold where we've been. But it's to allow more boats in, it's just unstable. I don't know that it's a good idea. But the market condition is not any better.
Okay. Did you have...
If we've got 82 permits, not all 82 of them fished last year. If somebody wants to get in, they can contact one of the 82 and try to buy one of those permits. Can't they?
No, not right now. Not right now.
We've so got a lock on it.
But okay, those, no, but the few that are interested in you know, that's...
So what we're talking about is whether or not to set up eligibility to transfer.
I mean, basically, we
what are the criteria?
Five or six individuals, you know, coming to staff, appearing before AFMAC on multiple occasions, asking to be let back into...
If I wanted to buy a black sea bass permit, what's the eligibility? I mean, what do I have to do to qualify to buy that permit? So in this case, why wouldn't it be the same thing as a black sea bass permit?
We have too many. There's too many people in the fishery with 82 permits. We talked about this in back in the 90s when it was wide open. We only had 30 or 40 vessels.
Mm-hmm.
If we open this up and all 82 vessels become active, we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot. We can't get the price up now with a limited. We're only producing half of our quota. If all of a sudden you've got 82 vessels, guys going after this, and we start doubling our quota, we're never going to get this market up. So we don't need 82 people fishing. That's why we're not allowing transfers. Right? That's why we've put a hold on it.
All right. So are we also talking about then if you haven't fished in the last 2 or 3 years, you lose your permit?
We did that for 2 years, and that's how we got from 102 or 107 down to 82. The problem we're facing now is all 82 are active because we've only got 30 or 40 active boats in this fishery. But I can sit here off the top of my head and tell you five boats that have 2 to 3 permits
per
vessel, and they're keeping the permits active. So if we want to move to transfers, I still feel the best way is to, and Spiny Dogs have to be sold to a federally permitted dealer, so we know the vessels. So if we could shrink it down to one permit per vessel owner and truly get this down to the amount of vessels, and it's 30 or 40 or 50, whatever it is, then I think we might be able to open it up and say, okay, this fishery will hold 40 vessels. We can open it up and move forward with this and move on in the fishery. Then you can buy in, you can get your permits. But I think that's the first step still is getting these permits down.
Okay. And without many oysters this year, more people are going to be looking to probably dogfish anyway.
A bad time right now, I think, yeah, to open anything.
You're going to be looking for something.
Yeah. Ernie. Thank you.
I brought this up, and I brought it up in the fashion that we wanted a very limited number. I mean, it won't be, and we had to have criteria. One criteria I think of right quickly is one of the gentlemen from Virginia Beach sold his boat, but he couldn't do anything with his permit to go with the boat, even though they, you know. So somebody bought a boat that was active in the fishery. Now it's not. The permit's still to the person who don't own the boat anymore. He still has the permit, I suppose. I guess he could let it go at any time he would want. But, you know, I think that would be one qualification. I agree with him. There's so many things went on. It was more prevalent down in Virginia Beach than it was home. When we were allowed at one time 300 pounds of trout to a person, and you could have up to 3 licenses on the boat. So they made sure that everybody on the boat had a license and a card so they could sell 300 pounds of trout, which made good sense. But then all 3 of them qualified for a spotted dogfish permit because they were all reporting at the same time. Right. So it wasn't just the vessel owner. It was the 2 people that were on the vessel with them have a permit also. That's the problem we saw all along, you know, and we discussed it, and we had a special committee set up for it. And, you know, Spot knew people that was in that situation. I certainly knew people in that situation. My son has a permit because he worked with me. He never had a boat to go, you know, anytime he's ever been is with me, and you got a lot of people in that situation. I don't know how we can address that. The problem I'm worried about is this. Almost, I would say the average age of dogfish permit holders is probably in their 50s. And I'm afraid down the road, if we don't let young people into some of these fisheries, there's not going to be any. You know, that's my concern, but I don't know. I doubt we caught half our quota last year. But the thing is, if we did catch the whole quota, could you do anything with them?
I don't think so.
You know, I think
if the timing were right, maybe, but it'd be difficult.
You know, just, you know, I've sold sea trade for years. So I feel like I'm kind of protected, but he probably don't want to take on a load of other people, and if he does, they're going to be the first people to go.
So are you saying that if you sell the boat and you don't buy a new boat, don't transfer the license, but if you sell a boat and buy a new boat, then transfer the license over?
No, the license is, this is a completely unusual situation. Almost every permit I own, the boat has. I don't have any federal permits. My boat has a lot of federal permits because the permits are issued to the boat. In this case, the permits were issued to the individuals. So if it was under the federal situation, mm-hmm. all those boats would only have one permit. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have had 3 permits or 2 permits or whatever people. Number. But, you know, we didn't have the ability to do that at the time. And now it's hard to do it after the fact. You got some people, that's good English too, you can tell I was. You have people that probably sometime in the future could get in the fishery, because some of the people on that has permits are probably younger people. They're not people who's probably fishing their own vessel right now, but you did have younger crew members, so you do have some chance. I just thought, you know, if people sell their boat and that boat was active, we had this discussion before a good while ago. I think the permits that should be allowed to be transferred are active permits, because then you're not increasing it. You know, if you take my permit and I let Beth have it, it's I'm out, she's in. You know, in all likelihood, she's going to catch no more than I did, so you're not increasing the quota. The problem we had before was the permits that were transferring were not active permits. They were people out to make, and they were $5,000 is what they sold for. Now you probably couldn't give anybody one, but, you know.
Except for the 5 people that
there were 23 cent when it, 23 and now 14.
Right. So, 10 years ago, we paid for 120 dogs, and
they were 15 cents a pound last year.
14. Right? 14. They've held at 14 for a couple of years now. But yeah, in the '90s, we paid 23 cents for them, and insurance, fuel, everything is higher, and really cheap fuel is what's hurting us now, because it makes a strong dollar, and it's a weak euro, and that's where these fish go. So it helps the watermen cheaper fuel, but not on on a sales end. But I agree with you as far as an active permit. So if we could come up with a number, if it's a 100,000-pound permit or 100, you know, the permit is landed 100,000 pounds, then I think we could consider transfers, because we don't want a guy that just reports a couple catches a year to keep his permit active to be able to sell that permit or transfer that permit and become a huge active permit. So that's a possibility. We could get down to that.
You know, I think what we need to look at, and we were talking about a limited amount before, yeah, 3 to 5, whatever number happens to be, they should be active permits that can be transferred. Because if someone does sell their vessel, and you got a lot of people who's getting older,
right,
and if they sell their vessel, they keep the permit. The man that has the boat has, you know, no permit. So that, and it actually helps probably the watermen down the road be able to sell their boat if they can sell permits with it. I can sell every permit I have with my boat, with the exception of my spawning office permit.
Could you have that active permit clause in there unless there is a medical situation? I mean, because life happens. I mean, put a medical parameter in there. Like, let's say someone gets sick and ends up in the hospital that year and can't fish. Why should they have to justify and lose their permit because of circumstance?
All right. Well, they could transfer theirs in a case like that. If they would have a doctor signed off saying they're on them.
If
I can't see.
If I
got the
right. So the medical is in there, and you're suggesting that stays, but a separate criteria would be that an active permit would also be allowed.
Can you pin it to active permits and then limit the new permit holder to the poundage that was landed by the previous owner, so that we don't increase the...
Or a Class A, Class B.
Some parameter or something?
Or just whatever the two-year average for the previous owner was.
I don't think you really can do that, Jeff. I think what you need to do is set a minimum, like he suggested. You know, 100,000 pound, or and make it so you can't use 2015, for example, so somebody can't, you know, land them in somebody else's
name. You would
name,
have to back that like we've done.
Back it up 13, 14. They had to have at least 50,000 pound a year for 2 years or whatever to be an active permit. Somebody that goes out and catches 10,000 pound, because that's kind of a threshold on a lot of things to keep your permits 10,000 pound.
Yeah.
But we still run into a problem if you've got two guys on a vessel. I'll use Ronnie Reed and his son, for example. Father-son team, their number goes on there every day. If they land 100,000 pounds, they each get credit for that. So how does that?
Well,
we
have a vessel trip limit, so you know they're stuck to one.
Correct. They can only land.
Even if they have two permittees, and a lot of these guys are stuck working together. So the people that were willing to dogfish are now out there working together. You know, so a lot of times two, sometimes three permittees on one boat with one trip limit. And one of the things they'll do on state reports, they're able to, as Ernie said, they're able to list that they're all on there.
But does each of them get full credit, the same amount of credit, or do they divide it by three?
They give credit at this point. Yes, we kept them all in the fishery based on the fact that they were there.
Well, yeah, but each one of them gets, if it's 100,000 pounds that's landed, each one of them gets 100,000 towards their license? What's going on now?
Well, right now, we're not trying to find out how much any one individual has. When we looked at activity, it was just whether you were there. We haven't looked at poundage.
Sorry, they were just active.
Yeah, it would have to be my vessel.
To get from the 140 to the 82, was there a control date or any criteria set?
Yeah, it was.
What was the date?
107.
All they had to do was they had to have 1 pound during the two seasons from May 1, 2010 through April 30, 2012.
May 2010?
Yeah.
To when?
April 30th, 2012. So that's two seasons.
1 pound?
Yeah.
Okay. If you continued that for 13 and 14, how many more would you eliminate? You've already set that date.
Yeah, a lot. We've had quite a few of the 82 say, look, you're going to penalize us for the fact that there was absolutely no market.
I couldn't possibly make money going out there doing this in the past two seasons. That doesn't mean this isn't something I need to be able to do at some point in time. But I could go out there and get, you know, $60 a bushel for oysters, or I could get 12 cents every once in a while when I was allowed to land this fish.
Okay. So you could go from April of 2012 to April of 2015 and put a 5,000-pound limit. And if you didn't land 10,000 pounds, if you didn't land 10,000 pounds in that time period, you're now a Class B permit. Everybody else that did would be a Class A permit. I hate to split it into two classes, or just leave it the way it is and eliminate those from, I mean, the idea is to shrink it down so it's manageable.
I think the whole goal is to get it to where it's transferable, but I don't see it being transferable until we get it down to, let's just say, 40 permits. So we've got to figure out a way to do that without hurting the full-time guys that are realistically in this fishery. And I think if we go by vessels, because if you've got three cards on one vessel, you can eliminate two right there. And that vessel still goes to work. It's still an active vessel. And we can get it down to a reasonable number of permits where now we can say, okay, you can transfer, you can use agents. And and we should be able to get that data simple enough, because as a federally permitted dealer, we have to report the vessel. So we know which vessels are active. Is that a possibility of taking that route to get to the number to get to transfers?
So what we're talking about then, you take that May 2010 number and bring it up to 2014 or 15 and look at the number of look at the vessels that landed and the amount they landed in that time period, and change your permits from individual people to vessel permits for that time period.
Instead of doing a vessel permit, we should do the boat owner permit, because I think vessel permit, isn't that a whole new set of problems for staff to go about permitting the vessel versus the individual boat owner? Would that be a better way versus the vessel permit?
The whole shooting from the hip right now is going to be really interesting. So,
yeah.
We're not going to solve this all right now.
Right.
But we're narrowing down the data we need to get to the number we need.
I have a question, Joe. A couple years ago, I think you guys sent out letters to the people to see if they're active or inactive, and then that's kind of how we got a parameter to reduce it. Were there anybody, what kind of a response did you get from that, and is that something that can be done in terms of getting data on suggestions from them that hold the permit of what they think would be fair in order to...
No, I mean, they had to have documented landings. That's so if they had to have harvest reported either to us or to the feds. That's all we used. We didn't ask them whether or not they were active. So there wasn't any communication in that sense. I do know that, quite a few of the 82 that hold these licenses want to hold on to these licenses. And if two of them are working together or three of them are working together, then you're asking, quite
that's
a few individuals
friction.
To sacrifice these licenses. And again, what they're going to say is you're going to be basing this on a time when I couldn't possibly go out. You know, the fish house that I sell to is saying, I can't take them.
Yeah.
So I couldn't go out.
So they went oyster.
Yeah.
Now they're not going to be able to make it oystering.
I've never turned down a dog boat, so I've never told somebody, no, I can't take your fish. So I don't know that that would be an issue. And the problem is we said if you don't use your permit during those 2 years, you lose it. So I can guarantee you every one of those 82 are staying active.
Yeah, they're going to use the minimum to keep it.
But they're right. They're getting on with the buddy, or they're saying, put my number down, or that they're making sure those permits are going to be active. Correct. So that's going to be the problem with saying, okay, if it has no activity now, you lose it again, because they all have got to have activity.
I was just hoping for 10 people in that mix saying, you know what, we're really not using this, but that's not going to be the case is what you're saying.
But going back to a threshold and you see that they have you know, it could be a poundage threshold, or it could be a number of trips. I mean, we know, you know, we've had a 3,000-pound trip limit, a 3,300-pound trip limit, a 5,000-pound trip limit. I mean, you could quickly look and see, you know, who's made 10 trips in the past.
But right or wrong, we've done that in every fishery. We've, you know, so you got guys that are saying, well, I want to hold on to this permit. I'm sure you had oyster guys that wanted to hold on to their permit, and crabbers. You know, we've cut crab license, we've cut oyster license, we've cut, you know, gillnet licenses. So it's every fishery we've done that in. If guys aren't utilizing the fishery, and right or wrong, but that's the course we've been on. So, you know, they're saying they don't want to lose their permit. Well, the 200 guys just got cut out of oyster and didn't want to lose their permits either, but it's just the...
Let's think this out, because the commission's going to be reeling from what they did last month. You know, there are already a couple of hundred calls that have come in, lawsuits, everything else, the typical things that happen with limited entry. If you want to come up with something for us to look at, then we ought to profile the vessels, that's what you want us to do, in the time period that you want to suggest, whether it's from 2000 forward, and then we show you what's there, and then we go forward. But we have to bring the commission into this too, because you know, they're going to have to know that this is going forward as well. So that report will be made on the 22nd. But just pick how you want us to look at this, and you know, we don't have to tie it down, but we need that to go forward.
Yes. All these dogs are reported federally.
Correct.
There's how many packing houses are packing them now? You, Chincoteague?
Half a dozen. You got Daryl, JR, Chincoteague, or, you know, Red, Juan Cheese, me.
If you can get another one,
who am I?
That's it.
I'm pretty sure that's it. I don't think Juan Cheese does
that. How about Southern Connections, Maryland, up that way? Who?
He's in Maryland.
Right.
But
I don't think he bought that in Virginia dogs.
So you're, that's all got to be reported on the safest system. You can download that. You can get that number of boats. It's probably 30 or 40 boats. And then just associate the permits with those boats. You can have that list before the next meeting to start breaking something down.
Yeah.
I have a question. Can we do it this way? Just say X number of boats had three permits landing on that boat. X number of boats had two permits reporting on the landing. You know, X number of boats had
one. Yeah, and I'm assuming that there's a federal permit, right? And I'm assuming that's on the boat, right?
But not all vessels have a federal permit.
They don't have to, right?
They don't have to.
So that's one of the unique things. That's another unique thing about this fishery is at times it's operating in federal waters, and so it's doing something different than when it's in
state. But even if you catch it in state waters, you have to report it federally.
Yes.
Yes.
And when you report it federally, you have to report it with a boat name.
Correct.
Yeah.
And a federal permit.
Yes. However, here's the thing.
Are you reporting your number?
A lot of the guys, when they're in state waters, do report to us. Just it's habit. They actually,
right.
You know, and they're listing everyone that's on the boat. In those cases, we can tell you everyone that's on the boat. If it's only through the federal system, that doesn't have to be done, and it isn't done. And so in those cases, we can't.
No, but...
So it's a mixed bag of...
But Daryl and Scott and Red know...
We're looking at the boat,
and the boat owner knows who was on the boat.
I have an idea that's really out of the box. I'm almost embarrassed to say it because it's just straight out of the box. What if we have something like, because you still got four or five guys that desperately want to get in this dog fishery.
We do.
What if we have them at a limited entry and give parameters to, what do you say, 45 boats out there really dog fishing, and they've got to set a parameter because they're used to bringing in X amount of fish. And then we got I don't even want to say this to impugn anybody, but like a Class A and Class B license type of thing, and do it with the dogfish. So the people that want to work can work. Is that completely out of the, you know, is that a possibility, or is that just completely so far out of the box that it wouldn't make sense?
Again,
the regulation is very straightforward. That's all I would say about that. The regulation has to be very clear no matter what you do.
Well, it would be for each section. Clear regulation for this class of dogfish license and a clear regulation for this class dogfish license. I'm just looking at people that want to work and letting them work. Because you've got like 40 some boats that really aren't accessing it.
No, I know, but again, I mean, Beth, my concern is that to tie it back to the most recent years and say you're knocked down to a Class B because you didn't do much, which is what we've done in the other fisheries, but this is market driven. Whereas, you know, with oyster, we said, look, this resource is in trouble. Either everybody, including the lots of full time people, take a massive hit to this, you know, and are down to nothing and can't even make a day's work. Or some people that have worked less than 20 days, you know, are gonna be kicked out of this.
The dogfish takes off. Maybe we could have 10 entries that go back up to Class A. A lot of
quota right now, you know. And I mean, so it.
Well, we do, but we're also facing perhaps 3 years of half that. Perhaps 3 years.
Right.
So the proposal is half.
You could do it from the day we issued permits. Go back to 2000. Was it 2008 when we first? You got 2009 on there, but
no, that's when we set the limited entry.
Okay, so just go back to 2009. Since the permits came into effect, that way your individuals who said, you know what, I dogged for 4 years, all of a sudden dogs were cheap and oyster, it made more sense for me to stay home and oyster, and now they're not going to be able to oyster anymore. Correct. We shouldn't penalize those fishermen for not dog fishing because they just did the smart thing and they went oystering. So if we put it back to from when the permits went into effect, then we should cover those people, I would assume, versus picking 2010 or, you know, because yes, you've got, I can tell you, six fishermen on my dock that have been oystering for the last 3 years that haven't caught a spiny dog, but they caught, you know, plenty of them in 9, 10, 11, and, you know, 12 and 13, so as to not penalize them so we don't run into problems there.
Are there many fishermen that didn't land anything but the minimum in that period of time, that span?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, the minimums were very, you know, were not very restrictive. I mean,
well, I mean, for the whole
most recent was just having a pound, and prior to that, you know, it was 10,000 pounds, or if you look above that, you know, an average of 60 gillnet days. It wasn't even landing spiny dogfish and 1 pound of spiny dogfish. So the minimums have been true minimums to stay in this fishery.
Correct.
But like he said, how many are just at the minimum the whole time?
Yeah. I mean, we can certainly look at that.
Is there a minimum
I think
now? Is there a minimum now? It isn't after the permits were issued, 10,000 pound now?
Well, no. I mean, I guess we never talked about that.
That was just a criteria to get a permit. There is no minimum to maintain a permit.
Both of those were one-time events.
The only thing I could say, Jeff, when you look at Beth's suggestion, you could do something like that, but you'd have to do it with a control date and let everybody know who's coming in. When there's a problem, you're after the control date, you're going to be gone. I mean, that's the only way you could do it with our suggestion. You would have to have a way telling these people down the road that the fishery contracts and we start having problems, you know.
Well, they would still be allowed to dog fish. They would just have a different parameter to do so because they're not really using it. Because you're worried about the poundage in the overall end is what I'm saying.
Well, so, I mean, for a number that high, yeah. For
so that would give people the option that really aren't going to use it very much to go out and maybe use it.
Well, I mean, there was still that earlier discussion of setting a threshold for a transfer. You know, anybody that wanted to, and that, you know, we've talked about that.
Like a limited entry.
We talked about that with Blue Crab as well, that if you wanted to come in, it would have to be.
And I'm just thinking out loud. I'm just trying to throw ideas out.
It's already limited entry.
Yeah.
Seems like more. you're ready to it. Brian Plumley was on the commission. He was the only commission member who actually scolded staff and told him, why don't you go ahead and reduce it even further? And I said, well, because we're working with the Finn Fish Management Advisory Committee to move us along. Other than that, the commission has retracted since then. I think we should collectively as a staff think about your suggestions and come back with some different ideas, whether they're vessel-oriented, date-oriented, 2012, back to 2009, figure out what we can do. But, you know, clearly we've taken some time off that maybe we shouldn't have as a group on dogfish, and now we find out that not only will the fishery be truncated, just how much it'll end up truncated. It's going to happen.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, you know, that's my thought, that, you know, we should have more of a dogfish night next time around than we have a count of prey night.
Okay.
What did they do with the 2014 where they had the vessel mechanical failure? How does that?
No, that's part of it. That's part of the, you know, the Bigelow problem.
Right.
So they can't. The latest was that the Mid-Atlantic Council, and Katie May brought up the data of what the supposed quotas are, which are around $25 million for 3 years, down to $50 million. I don't know where it'll end up, but it's a 3-year running average of the spring trawl data. And that's what they use as an index for the female biomass. The female biomass is about 40-45% off. And 2012 was a good year, but they don't look like they're going to use 2012. Instead, they're going to average 2013 and 15, not use 2014 because there was problems with the equipment, as Scott mentioned. And so because of that, things all of a sudden, in a hurry, look pretty bad. Just last week, I was getting this information. Rick Robbins said you need to call the guy at the council because things are going on with dogfish. So, you know, okay. Part of that situation is that, you know, what's the half of the quota look? That's probably okay for us right now, but we should be looking towards a few more years down the road.
Correct.
A couple of years down the road, and what the fishery's going to be like then. So, you know, I'm not reluctant to push limited entry further at all. It's just that everyone has to be saying that's the best way to do it, and then with confidence we can go to the commission and say, well, FMAC, you know, they're behind this, the staff is behind this, here are the reasons why. But it takes all that to happen first.
Right. Joe, I missed the slide. Was it 42 is the most active boats we've ever had? You had the list up there of vessels.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And this was one of the things we talked about was a threshold in the past. So, you know, having at least 40,000 pounds in the last two seasons, or just 10,000 pounds in the last two seasons, and that was for further limiting the entry. But you know, you could even do that if you said, you know, keep the number of permittees, but if you wanted to allow a transfer, then you know would have to be a permit that had at least 30,000 pounds in the last 3 years.
Or you could collect three that equal 30,000, something along those lines.
Way to reduce permits too, yeah.
So we'll have options next meeting to talk about.
And I
one of the ideas where we started tonight, by the way, you know, before we came in, we were talking about just that. How do you look at, so you have the active transfer.
That amazes me right there.
Once we get down to counting the permits, it's probably going to be 50-50.
And can we look into reducing work on staff by changing the reg where we report weekly? Because somebody here has got to pull it off the machine, and my wife religiously sends that fax every. Well, that's striped bass. We're going to get to that next. But I mean,
the request being whether or being forced for a buyer to being forced to send these in, whether or not they even purchase first.
Right. With speckled trout, remember we said if we purchase. So you know, we only purchase dogs realistically 6 months out of the year, the other six.
And this is all going into safety.
And it's all going into safes.
She really does.
She's religious on that. She's but she's going, why do I got to do this? So I got to take, you know, it's a 0-0-0.
Yes.
And the same thing with striped bass in the month of December, calling every day, you know, which I don't think is necessary anymore, and it would reduce work on her and the ladies in the office. So I think it's a win-win. Everybody's shorthanded nowadays. So.
Okay, you're going to get some information for us. Right?
Yeah.
You'll get some information for us for the next meeting or sometime soon. And I think it's important to reiterate what Joe brought up. For the commercial fishermen, at least, you have to have some flexibility. If you're pinned down to one license and one fishery and that fishery closes, or the market goes south or whatever, we really need to keep that in mind, that these guys need some sort of flexibility they can stay alive. So.
Especially in the winter.
Okay. Yep. That's fine with me.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we did spinies.
It's only 10 spots.
This is MRIP, are we ready for? Is that what you're doing?
That's my question. Are you ready for it?
I don't know that we'll ever be ready for it.
Well, ready or not. Here comes APHIS. That's really what I'm going to talk about tonight. And what the heck is APHIS? It stands for Access Point Angler Intercept Survey. And it is actually something that's been in effect since the 2013. But what's new is states that had not previously conducted the site survey will be more involved in 2016. Virginia, Maryland, Delaware are just the example three of the states that have not participated in this directly. Although I see the raw data, in fact, I looked at it just before I came here today for this past month.
All right, let me interrupt you for just a second because I ended the last session too early. Was there any comment from the audience on the spiny dogfish transfer? Yeah, that figures. That's probably okay. Well, I'll give him a chance, won't we? Okay.
This is good point.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of questions. I don't think so. The Virginia legislature has approved a budget which is fully funded by NOAA back in January 2015. This budget includes salary money to hire 3 full-time employees. And the money for the lead biologist is available starting October 1st. In fact, the listing has been closed and we've got the position has been advertised, over a dozen applications have been received, and these are currently being evaluated. Money for the other 2 FTEs will become available prior to December 1st. The survey will also be supported by part-time individuals hired through a temp agency. This is also included in the budget from NOAA. What is not changing is NOAA will continue to conduct a draw, which is their statistical way of pulling up assignments and for all the states, not just the new states. NOAA has done this in the past. They will continue that role. And NOAA will conduct the participation portion of the survey and generate the final estimates. But so you're wondering, well, what's the state actually getting out of this? And we've learned something from the other states that do it. Is one thing, Virginia's going to be more involved with the survey. It determines quotas and allocations for the states. Virginia will have immediate feedback from anglers because we'll have state employees out there interviewing anglers as they come in. Direct interaction with the anglers by state employees should foster better cooperation and confidence, and over time we believe our state add-ons will be less expensive as we become more efficient. And lastly, there'll be better knowledge of site pressure, individual sites. Virginia has over 200 sites in our site register, and it's been up to the private contractor to keep these pressure ratings up to date for any new locations. Now, the state will be directly involved with that. So those are the advantages we see from it. But starting March 1 is when, in Virginia, we start with wave 2, and March 1, this will be in place. It's not new from NOAA's point of view. From NOAA's point of view, the states now are taking on essentially the role of the private contractors in the past. And we've got an additional help is coming from ACCSP in that they are the ones that are actually going to do the data entry and code it and then move it on to NOAA fisheries. And along the way, all the states will have support from ACCSP and NOAA fisheries, who both have invested a lot of money in this.
Lewis, the surveys being done at the boat landings and so forth at
Access Point Intercept.
Yeah, I mean, that's been going on for years and years, but on a very limited basis, at least in Virginia. I mean, I've been fishing 40 years or something, and I think I've had the questions asked one time. But my point is, how does this new program affect the frequency of the data collections, and, you know, will it lead to much more accurate information?
Well, that's the goal. That's what we hope. I can tell you this, in the 2 years that since 2013, when the first redesign of this of the MRIP began, I can look at the composition of fish and the raw data I just looked at, and I can see there's a lot more variable. They're going to sites. They're spending time at sites now. As the argument, it's a shame Tom Powers isn't here, because we all remember Tom Powers' argument with, geez, the reason the rockfish numbers poundage is so high is they're all going to these busy sites, and in the wintertime it's all lower bay, and they're all 20-pound plus fish. So the average size fish is much greater than when realistically there's significant fishing going on up in the tributaries where they've got school size fish. Well, I can tell you just by looking at the composition of the catch, they're spending more time getting more assignments up in these low pressure sites. And that's really what a big part of the redesign. Now, to compensate for this, and this is where it gets into that black box, what is NOAA doing? Well, no one really knows. And you even wonder if NOAA knows what they're doing, is different sites will carry different weights. So an intercept at one site will not count as much as an intercept from another site. So there's a lot of statistical, these word voodoo, but I mean statistical analysis that goes into this. And the real big change has been, notice I mentioned that the NOAA fisheries will do the site draw. The big difference is, ahead of time, they know all the sites and all the assignments that are going to be pulled. The survey person can't freelance. Gee, it's rainy or windy. There's no boats in the trailer here. I'm going to go to Owls Creek. I know they're doing something there. So they oversample an area like that. They don't have that latitude anymore. The way that the clustering of sites goes, they may, during their six-hour assignment, actually move to another site, but it's already been weighted and pre-calculated. And that's one of the things that it's a real problem if they can't do the site. I mean, if their car breaks down or for whatever reason. So it behooves the person that we'll be hiring to have plenty of backup. So, okay, what if this happens? And then what if the what if happens?
What months of the year will the highest concentration of intercepts be done? Is it more a summertime, you know, May to September or what?
Do have some level of latitude in that of how to distribute the NOAA assignments or what they call the base. We have complete latitude if we do add-ons. So that is one of the things we'll look at is that, geez, we've got a flounder fishery in early spring that we think really neat. We can look at the resulting, what they call the precision estimates. We really think we need to add samples at that time of the year. And we can specify to add samples to a certain mode. By mode, it's private rental boat or charter boat or shore mode. We can't say, well, I want you to sample more at Kittatinny State Park. You can't do that, but you can select mode and time of year to increase the number of samples. And within reason, NOAA will adjust their base to suit your requests. But definitely when we do the add-ons where we go to the Recreational Advisory Board and request additional sampling, we have full latitude where we put them on the map. And there we're thinking, well, geez, we could use some more intercepts at that point.
Okay, thanks.
To put it in perspective, I think we've got our NOAA base with the add-ons is 740 assignments. And right now, roughly 100 of those are add-ons that were money we take from the request from the rec board. And what has happened is over time, because the NOAA budget hasn't increased, but all other salaries have, including those in the private contractors, their cost for assignment has gone up. So you see the base has shrunk over time. At the same time, they're pumping money in and trying to get more accuracy. The one thing that any of your statistical people will tell you, if you increase sample size, definitely should increase accuracy.
What is the role of the biologist? There's one biologist.
The biologist, he's going to spend a lot of time here working with the data, coordinating everything from the office. He'll be out doing some quality control. He'll do some call up.
You will?
Did I say D?
Okay.
I thought I said D.
All right.
You missed me.
Okay.
I misspoke. I said deep.
Any other questions from the committee?
I just want to make one comment. The next slide should have said, we're in a heap of trouble.
Oh, yeah.
We've gotten sold a rocking horse that doesn't rock. National Marine Fisheries Service has been criticized for 20 years on this survey. It was a brilliant move to work through ASMFC and get the rest of the states to do this survey. There's no win here. At all. As a matter of fact, what I told you earlier is even worse because Lewis, I, Joe, other people will have to put time into getting this survey started up and maintained. It doesn't help us with our core responsibilities. You won't see any MRIP people running around here too much because they'll be out. But it's really, I mean, we're in a bit of trouble, quite frankly. It's going to be tough times. We have that, and we have a sturgeon project. We start by the first of the year with two employees. Now, none of these five employees pitch in to the current workload as you know it. They're all dedicated to those particular workloads, MRIT and Sturdy.
Are you able to add any more people?
We don't know. There's been some proposals, but, I mean, that's all a matter of, general sentiment at this point. But if you are looking for something, you just let me know, okay?
Looking for something to do?
There could be part-time work, too.
I'm retired. I don't have any time to do anything. I still don't understand it. All right. Thank you, Lewis. You had some comment, I think, about the spiny dogfish transfers. Would you like to? I'm sorry I didn't bring this up earlier. If you'd give us your name and your opinion, I'd appreciate it.
James Close, sold the spot for many days. But as a dog fisherman, as we were talking about quotas, the last 2 years spot, I've come down there to make my landings.
Right.
Most time I break even, I pay my health, and you see me come down there by myself for how many years? Because at 20 cent, 30 boxes, as you know, the numbers are always not there. Mm-hmm. with the market the way it is and everything else, there's only, what, how many of us, 42 left in this? Like you said, if all 42 come into here, we've gone, what, before Christmas, before we caught the low quota?
Right.
As a full-time commercial waterman, I'm trying to juggle oystering, dog fishing, we'll cut out the crabgrudge industry. So now I've just been recently cut out of the oyster scrape industry. Before you start making cutbacks, you really need to know who the full-time waterman is and how much money and gear they have tied up into this. You know, and what I've done, and John, and all we've done to try to keep our license is a big deal, because sometimes it costs us money just to hold on to our permits. So just be real careful, because not only will it cost, you know, like I said, I just got $10,000 in gear. If I get kicked out of it, with the dredging, I got $40,000 worth of gear at home. That's no good to me. So before we start, we need to really go into in-depth in this. And really, as Spot would know, to try to push for having local market. As we were talking with the Cardinal Grays, we're shipping all our stuff overseas. Why can't we learn how to try to figure out how to cut them and keep them in America? Plain and simple. We can't sell them overseas and get up on it. A 14-cent fish, you're trying to make money on 14-cent. Spot can't make no money. Why should I keep fishing for something that I can't make money on when I can stay home and do something else? All right.
Thank you. Excuse me, just a minute.
Did you dog fish this last winter?
I went last one.
Jimmy comes down just to work for 2 weeks to make sure he has landing so he doesn't lose the permit.
Keeps enough poundage.
Right, and, yeah. it really, he's got to pay for a boat slip at Rudy Island for the whole month.
Just so to make sure he doesn't lose
if,
the permit.
If you get bad weather days, then he'll end up losing. You know, if you can do it all winter, you can make money doing it, but he was better off staying home and oystering. So that's what I was saying as far as allowing flexibility for boats to move from fishery to fishery. But
it's not that I've been, the last 2 years I'd have been better off stay home oystering.
Right.
You know, but just to keep my license, I go there for 2 weeks. Well, once you start getting into the January months, February months, you don't get no time.
Yeah.
You go
weather wise,
2 days a week, 3 days a week. You know, one day, sometimes you're tied up for a whole week.
Yeah.
Your profit margin goes to nothing.
So, but last year you landed 10, 20,000?
I think it was up until.
Yeah, I don't remember.
50 boxes for like 2 weeks. I don't think we missed over a couple days.
And did you said you were cut out of oystering this new round of.
Well, what I'm saying is we're trying to do a juggling.
No, I understand, but I just want to make sure I didn't misunderstand you. The oystering, I know they're cutting back this year.
If it was scraping, I'm still trying to go pat and tongue it. But if that goes south, then I got to try to go dugging.
When
that 14-cent fish, you can't make that.
Right. Pat and tongue, though, they've cut the limit back on that also, right?
They froze getting any more licenses if you haven't gotten it between 2013 and 2018. That was done. So
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
But what I'm saying is we're trying to do this juggling act of trying to keep everything we got.
Right.
And if you only go so many days doing this or so many days doing that, and they say, well, okay, you didn't work, like myself, oyster scraping, I lost it by so many days.
Right.
It's starting to get into a wall, running into a corner where you cannot get out. You have no avenue as a full-time commercial fisherman. You need to depend on all these little items to make it through this, because if two will go south and you've been cut out of that one, you got nothing.
And that's been my point all along, where I've pushed the full-time commercial waterman. This needs to be a winter fishery, and that's why I keep coming back to the vessels, because that'll truly tell us who the full-time watermen are if we can get down to the vessels versus the individual permits.
Correct. So, you know, with that, just keep in mind how far you go back and what the poundage is, because like for 2 years when you take money out at your expense just to keep your license, you know, when you could be making money doing something else.
Right.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. It's, you know.
Uh-huh.
back so far, but Spot will tell you for about 6-8 years there, we landed every day, every day. We were pretty much
consistent.
I was pretty much, me and John pretty much placed a quota on that.
Right.
You know, every day, because some of them were conking and just doing it on the side. We were doing it every day. But when it gets down to where you can't financially make it, you keep your license, you try to keep them up so you have something else.
Thank you very much. Okay, summer flounder and regions, I guess, is the next item on the list.
We're all looking at each other.
Regional management and summer flounder harvest limit.
This is the recreational end of things, okay?
Right.
And it's still early. We're trying to find, and we're not going to find it just because people who left didn't keep it up. We're trying to find the mail out, the email list of folks that we used to send out information. I started up many years ago to keep them pace with what was going on with summer flounder and black sea bass. So we'll be doing that. I'm going to have to create another list so that you know what's going on. Right now it's early in the game. We have the May and June data. Do you happen to have that with you? No, you don't need to run down there. We're in a region. You know we're in a region with Delaware and Maryland. You know that the big guns are New Jersey and New York. And in 2014, it was a 6% overage of what they call the recreational harvest limit, which is a coastwide quota. Now, to compound that, there, and it hasn't been mentioned yet tonight because we're busy on dogfish, there's about a 25.6% reduction on the commercial and recreational sectors of summer flounder. So what is going to happen is the ASMFC by November hopes they have data through wave four, okay, August. And that should say which direction we're headed overall. I think when we looked at summer flounder, at least, it wasn't much for us in our region, but the other regions, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Rhode Island by itself, and Massachusetts by itself, there could be another problem there. The real problem is how are you going to make a 25% reduction and keep the regions intact? Now, if you don't remember this, 2 years ago, I argued pretty strenuously at the ASMFC against the regions. And it was a time when, you'll remember this situation, Governor Cuomo from New York got involved and started calling the states and called our chief of staff at the time, who John Bull, also the commissioner, got on the phone. And the chief of staff said, do what you want. Other states had to bend a little bit because of the political pressure. Why is political pressure on recreational summer flounder? Because it's a giant business in a lot of states, obviously. So we're going to have to keep you informed of this. It is a big situation for the recreational fishery. They used to say to us in the regions, when the regions were forming, they said, don't worry, Virginia, you're a donor state, meaning that we had a big share, 15.7% of the coastwide quota back from 1998 data. And so the idea was that since we're a donor state, that when time comes, we won't have to pony up a whole lot if reductions come about. I really seriously doubt that that's reality. I mean, you know, so we'll have to let you know what's happening, whether we have to go to a 17 or 17 and a half inch size limit, and I'm just using those as examples. It's possible. So, you know, that's what's going on with summer flounder. Black sea bass looks like a mess recreationally because we looked at the data, and I think they get a 2.2 million pound quota. Does that sound right, Rachel? 2.2 million pounds commercial and recreational, and the projection's about 2.9 million pounds. So that's going to be problems with black sea bass as well. And we're not causing them. You know, they're
There's a big, bigger fishery for them in the northern states. So I think I just wanted to get your attention tonight about the reduction that we face coming up, which will last for 3 years. I will tell you it could have been worse. It could have been like a 45% reduction. But there was some negotiation about risk and how much risk that they could get the scientists to really take on the overfishing limit. So, you know, it's kind of tough. We haven't had a really good year class of summer flounder since 2009, and each time they rerun the model, the data, 2009 keeps going down too. So there hasn't been much in the way of good year classes. You should remember that from striped bass as well. Other than 2011, the striped bass year classes have been average or a little below average. So, you know, that counts a lot when you're talking about reference points that are built on spawning biomass. It takes the fish to build that spawning biomass.
Rob, when will the decisions actually be made, both at ASFMC level and state level? Are we talking about December?
February is when you can probably expect the ASMSC to finalize everything. December is usually a joint meeting between the council and ASMSC, and it sets up the program for what, you know, can happen, but usually about February.
Do you have any feel for how Virginia's doing this year compared to last landings?
We're doing a little bit better. I saw that, you know, maybe about 50,000 fish better. We ended up with like 187 or 185,000 summer flounder for 2014. We should do a little bit better, but I haven't seen anything.
Better meaning less?
No, better amount of fish.
More landings.
Right.
And they based our part of that region on our worst year ever, so. Better is not actually better.
What is the word? Fluid or
careful.
Nebulous on what happened there.
Okay.
Because they actually used 2013 data, sight unseen, when we didn't do that well either. And then when they did the regions, they assumed pretty much that all the states would do that amount, and the rest went to the northern states.
Right.
It was really a strange process, I thought.
We fought it for a long time and were able to put it off, but.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And that brings us to the ASMFC actions from the early August meeting. Is that you again?
I won't take long. All of you should have received in an email the attachment for ASMFC. Does that sound familiar? Anybody? Okay. So ASMFC is a hotbed of all sorts of things going on. The interesting thing is, I'll just go through these a little bit from memory, but American lobster, we were kicked off the board because we're de minimis, meaning that we have less than 1% of the landings, and we petitioned to get back on the board, and we're on the board, but the big idea there was the Jonah crab. The Jonah crab has been bycatch in the lobster fishery, and what the ASMFC has said is if there's any Jonah crab fishermen outside of the lobster fishery, then they need to show proof that they have landed Jonah crab by some other means. So we have sea bass potters who've landed Jonah crab, and we also have situations where people have landed claws, so not the whole animal, but just the claws. We don't think we're going to have a whole lot of Virginia influence on that as far as getting involved with Jonah crab, but it's become pretty big in the northern area. Ken, have you ever caught any Jonah crab?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
We
go after them on purpose, and we get outside of state waters, so we're not in any of the state potting laws, you know, when the crab pot season closes, and we go catch them for talk bait. And so, yeah, the dedicated tog fishermen are out there with pots in federal waters catching Jonas.
I had a hunch.
Yeah.
All right.
That that big red crab that didn't deep water crab?
No, the Jonah crab, smaller, most of them we're catching crab. Smaller. Mm. And we're fishing just outside 3 nautical miles just to get out of the thing. But you catch them around the racks and stuff. Togs love them. And so they're all around the triangle racks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you will catch a hook and line, some of the bigger ones sometimes when we're tog fishing. We'll catch them. And then they become bait.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're interested in what happens with that.
Okay. when you hear more at the commission about lobster anyway. American eel, it was kind of interesting. They found Delaware out of compliance. I haven't heard anything since they found Delaware out of compliance. Once they vote them out of compliance, it goes up to the Secretary of Commerce and the Secretary of Interior. But for some reason, the way the law is written, it's the Secretary of Commerce who makes a determination. Any other out-of-compliance situation that I'm familiar with, and there are probably about 4 or 5, always the state always comes back into compliance. So there's never been a fishery shutdown since 1993 when all this started with the ASMFC. But there's plenty of hand-wringing about that. If you don't know it, we have a 9-inch size limit for American eel up from 6 inches. There's been 2 addendums that have been pushed through the ASMFC, and there's also a 25 fish bag limit per angler. I think the way they have it is that the charter captain can have 50, captain and crew. That's really old news pretty much, but you probably didn't hear it. The other thing is they have a rigorous reporting requirements for both buyer and harvester for us. That's unparalleled, to use Joe's words, for any other fishery. And Rachel just put in a plan today. You have to tell them how you're going to implement everything. And so you have to put in a plan there. So ASMFC is a lot of our life, obviously. Tautog, Joe is on the technical committee. This has been going on for a while, but there is a public document out there. There'll be a hearing here October the 6th. The big item about Tautog is Regions. The stock assessment and the peer review recommended there be a Delmarva region, and the big controversy was whether Connecticut should be with New York and New Jersey or whether Connecticut should be with Rhode Island and Massachusetts. No one wanted Connecticut. The reason is Connecticut is severely overfishing compared to any other single state. But at the same time, we are overfishing in our region, but we're not overfished. When you go further north, Massachusetts, Rhode Island area, and Connecticut, if it ends up with them, we don't know, they're overfished and overfishing. And the middle region, New York, New Jersey right now, overfishing but not overfished. Joe wants to say something.
Yeah, just really quick. Since we were talking about summer flounder regional management, these tog regions are just for the assessment. So we're talking about Delaware through Virginia as a single stock. And that's a good thing for us. Yeah. There's been no talk, and there's nothing in the public document about forcing us to stay within regional management of the 3 states. We still have state flexibility there, and there hasn't been anything proposed to have to do regional management. We'd all be on the same target, you know, for those 3 states. And things are actually looking pretty good there. They'll force a stock assessment update in 2016. We went through a lot of cuts. We spent a lot of time here talking about, you know, what's the appropriate season, what's the appropriate size limits. That's looked like it's had an impact for us. MREP has been in a good place for all 3 states. I think as soon as we get that 2016 update, we'll be out of the overfish status and we'll be in good shape. But there isn't any talk about forcing us into regional management. It's just regional assessment.
Thank you. Really good points, and I'll skip striped bass because they've already done everything they're going to do by taking a 20.5% reduction for the bay and 25% for the coast. So at some point when we get more information about how that fared in reducing fishing mortality. We'll let you know. The Menhaden Board has been pretty active. I know for some of you that's a very important species. The idea is that another amendment is on the way, Amendment 3. That amendment will do two things. It will look at allocation or reallocation, depending on how you want to look at it, of the way that the quotas exist now among the states. Right now, there's a state-specific quota. Virginia has 85.6% of the quota. There are certainly a lot of states that would like to have more quota. It's as simple as that. So allocation will be an issue. Then there's an ecosystem basis for menhaden management that's going along on a parallel track. It's called the BERP, which is Biological Ecological Reference Points. That's what they'd like to develop to where they bring it into more of an ecosystem context. There's already been a workshop on that. It was pretty, intense. And the allocation calls are pretty intense because there's a group of five board members, I think, on each of those, and then others participate as well. But the subgroup of the full board is what's been meeting. I've been on those calls. There's another one Thursday. And, you know, it's hard to say where it ends up. I mean, it really is. It's too difficult to say. Everyone wants to have the ecological context for reference points and for everything. But, you know, maybe menhaden has a shot to do that as opposed to some of the other forage fish. But we'll see. And, you know, next time around I can give you an update. And I think really that's about it that is going on. There'll be a meeting of the ASMFC from November the 2nd through November the 5th, and that's going to be in Florida. And I'm sure that there'll be, you know, some pretty interesting things there. They used to try and do they call it the annual meeting. It's the only meeting that's not held in Alexandria. But once a year, they hold it in, they vary the state. And they used to, what I remember, is keep everything kind of light, and then that's all gotten ruined. They've had some pretty rough issues at annual meetings, striped bass being a notable one a few years ago back in 2011. So that's going on. The Mid-Atlantic Council will meet October 4th through 6th, and the flounder issues won't get much traction there right now, but certainly, there'll be plenty to talk about spiny dogfish. That's going to be a big issue that's debated, and hard to say what else might come up. But you can listen to those. There are webinars for both. And so if you find yourself able to multitask, you can tune in to one of the webinars, which are terrible things because as a state representative, someone says to you later on, I heard what you said. So that's it for me.
All right. Thank you. I believe that's all the current business. We go to new business now. And go ahead. Come on up and tell us who you are and what's on your mind.
I'll just take 2 minutes. I'm Mike Avery. I'm a representative with the newly formed Virginia Saltwater Sport Fishing Association, and I'd like to just request two items be put on a future agenda for the committee. We don't have to talk about it tonight or make any decisions tonight, but one of them is cobia. We've been doing some polling with recreational anglers, and there's a concern about the direction cobia is going and that we may be headed in the wrong direction, and so I'd like to just request for in the future that the FMAC committee put on the agenda, look at the issue, maybe have some public comment. I'm not here to try to propose any specific reduction measures, but I think we ought to be concerned about it and look at it. Just informal polling in various medium, it looks like about 70% of the anglers that we've polled so far are in favor of some sort of reduction for cobia for recreational anglers. Now, I need to make sure that's not some sort of Abilene paradox thing going on where it's just everyone's agreeing with everybody else. But, you know, it does appear that there's a lot of concern. So I'd like to just request that be a future agenda item. We've got lots of time to decide between now and when the cobia show back up.
Okay.
The second one is just, it's not from the association, it's just a personal agenda item, and it's again, I'd like to put it on the agenda for a future item, and that's grouper, inshore grouper. There has been an incredible explosion of juvenile gag grouper being caught inside the bay and off the piers. And I know our current recreational limits is one per angler if you have a permit. And that was really designed for offshore fishing where we catch the larger grouper. Well, now we have a significant number of groupers being caught along the Bay Bridge Tunnel. I'm talking about little ones, you know, like 5 inches long. And the anglers that are catching them don't know what to do with them, and they're keeping them and boxing them. And even if you had a permit, I don't think personally that we should be keeping 6-inch grouper. And just in case we have a grouper fishery develop in the future where these little juvenile grouper are imprinted to come back to their spawning grounds and they get larger every year and they come back, I would like to have some sort of guidance on what to do with these fish as they're being caught. Whether you have a separate, state limit or inshore fishery versus offshore fishery, because right now there is no size limit for grouper. It's just one per boat. And so legally they could keep a 6-inch grouper. And I just don't think that we should. So I would like to request that the committee look at this and see is there some sort of guidance could be issued in the future for inshore grouper.
Good points.
And that's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much. We can look into that, Rob, I hope. Any other new business? Yes, please, Robert.
I had a number of calls about this electric shocking catfish. Is it too early for you to give me any insight on that?
Well, you probably know as much as anyone else, I would think. But so electrofishing has been going on for many years. The game department uses it regularly. Used to be in the striped bass survey that they did, and they certainly used it for blue catfish. I'm going to get to the ending in a minute, but Virginia Tech's been doing a survey for 3 years with the game department, and the idea is to know really about the feeding and everything else of blue catfish. So that's almost done. We've had one harvester who has had a electrofishing permit from us. He originally and still this year was funded through the Fisheries Resource Grants Program out of VIMS, along with, you know, Tom Murray's program over there. And last year, he was in the James. There were a few areas in the James that he was concentrating on. And we met with him sort of mid-season, maybe sometime in late July or something like that. And he wanted to move to the Pamunkey but didn't have any contacts, didn't know if he wanted to trailer his boat, didn't have a place to leave his boat. Eventually, he went to the Pamunkey and did pretty well. So he started up again this year. The whole project is concerning the gear, but also, you know, its effect maybe within the fishery. So we started to get a lot of flack this year, not so much last year, but this year from traditional fishermen, hoop netters. Rachel can tell you a lot about a hoop net if you want to know, but I think most of you have seen.
Still not tonight. Exactly.
I thought he said she left, which, you know, don't abandon ship yet. But so they have traditional fisheries for catfish, blue catfish, upriver, and catfish in general. And I think they're concerned, at least everyone I've talked to is concerned about the effects of the electrofishing on the other species and also on their take of blue catfish because it can be disruptive. I don't know so much about that end of it, but
I know it's a real low frequency that they're using for shocking these blue catfish, and it's kind of a quick operation, although there is a little bit of evidence that it can sort of stymie fish from being in the area for a little while. So I think the plan eventually of the agency is to at least look at development of this, not to where we have 100 electrofishers, but to where each tributary maybe can have one to keep on looking at this possibility. The one positive aspect of this is bycatch, that, you know, the hoop nets and other devices, other potters, they're going to get a lot of juvenile fish from time to time. With this apparatus, I'll call it, you know, they pop up, you grab them as quick as you can, and you're done. And it only affects certain sizes of fish. So I think that's where it stands, although I'm convinced that we have to have a sit-down with the traditional, I'll call them the traditional fishermen, and the commissioner, and sort of, you know, let them speak openly together about the situation.
That's one of their concerns is, will they be able to get a permit to do this?
Some of them who don't like it want a permit too, which is a little different take. But, I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, I think this has to be, a big part of this is Tom Murray at VIMS. A big part of this is the commissioner, and then you've got fisheries as well. So I don't think we've gotten to that stage yet, but I can't imagine multiple electrofishing gear in a small area. I just can't imagine it. But, you know, we'll see. And I don't think that will happen, quite frankly. But I do see that it's possible. The goal here is it is an invasive species, right? It's an introduced species. And everyone has been looking for ways to constructively winnow down the population enough so that it's not the biggest part of the biomass, especially in the James River. And that extends to all the states, you know, that have a problem. Maryland has a problem. Virginia has a problem. PRFC has a problem. And so, you know, if I can not think about fisheries management, but think about practicalities. If you have an invasive species and you're targeting fish that are essentially under 32 inches, because you can only have one that's 32 inches or greater, then it's almost like a sustained removal. And although the thoughts were that you couldn't impact the large spawning fish, that, you know, you're not going to have a big impact there, I think that's the objective. Now, there's a sport fishery. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that. There's a guide service. It's a big sport fishery. And I was at a meeting during the probably the early part of the summer, and it was on blue catfish. And, you know, one of our legislators has big problems with blue catfish and blue crab. And, you know, they do overlap. From what I know, and Joe might know better, they can reach about 13 or 14 parts per thousand. They're a freshwater fish. So where are your juvenile blue crabs? They're, you know, there's definitely overlap. And someone from the game department, I'm just telling you what I heard. I'm not, you know, saying anything that I didn't hear at the meeting, said, you know, this is a $6 million business, this sport fishing. And, I mean, I didn't mind saying that blue crabs are roughly a $30 million business for the Commonwealth, and that's not even in a terrific year. So there's a lot going on. I hope that's enough information. You probably have a lot of information too, but I can't answer that question about how much gear is going to be there.
They're mainly concerned if they are going to be able to get a permit. Now, Georgia's study is over at the end of this January 31st.
Right.
And then for what we're under the understanding is that you will evaluate whether somebody else will be able to
with
do
them.
This.
We have to do the permit. And right now it's in a permitting situation. It could move to a regulation at some time. I think George will be done early October. He'll be done.
Weather, pretty
shortly.
Temperature.
Yeah, water temperature. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I don't see it as a bad problem to have this to think about. It's just that it's going to take more than just VMRC. It's going to take VIMS. It's going to take others to sort of plan the future.
The guys up the river that are hoop netting,
okay,
need to be involved in this conversation.
Right.
If they want to get a permit and they want to be involved in it, they need to come and be involved in that conversation when it happens.
Yeah, they're very involved on the phone.
John Ivey, he don't have a problem because he has a market. My problem's always been a market.
Yeah.
I mean, I can catch catfish. That's no problem. But I have a market. Now, Amory doesn't, you don't do it.
The market's getting better and better every year. Because of what George is doing, the market's actually getting better.
Super. That's good.
I'll buy everyone you can bring me.
Super. All right. All right. Blue catfish.
Any other new business?
No.
Anything from the audience?
Yes, sir.
All right. Do we have a next meeting date?
I've been dealing with him a little bit lately. Selling some
okay.
Send
something out.
He's a good guy.
And I think what we should do.
He's hard-headed.
Joe and everyone else on the spot. Yeah. But when we send out the next meeting notice, we'll send some of the dogfish information so that you can look it over and we'll give you some lead time before the meeting.
Okay.
But I would like to see some progress there. We really got stalled out.
All right.
Right.
So.
All right. Do we have a motion to adjourn? Second? Everybody. So, thank you very much.